This is Terry Crosby.
Andy Steiger.
Steve Kim.
Welcome to the AC Podcast. On this podcast, we want to help you understand and speak the language of our culture and address questions being asked with intellectual honesty, gentleness, and respect. Welcome back, guys. We are glad to be with you listeners again.
Good to be here.
This week, a couple days late, but we're going to get it out today. This is Friday. But we were at an important event last night, which we'll get into. But I've been doing a little digging on the internet.
Yeah, yeah.
I got one little story here for you. I love how it starts. It says, God's name in vain. V-E-I-N. The title says, biohacker injects himself with DNA sequence made from Bible and Quran verses.
I don't know how to understand that.
I know. It's a little... So this teenager injected himself with the DNA sequence made from parts of the Bible and the Quran. So
break that down for me. I'm still not with you.
Okay. He made a DNA strand from chemicals represented by the letters A, C, G, and T, and all genes encoded by these four letters. Mm-hmm. So he replaced every Hebrew character in the Bible of Genesis with DNA code, excluding a few verses because they were controversial. Going in order of G-A-C-T. So this kid develops a DNA and injects himself with it, by verses within the Bible and the Quran, just to see what would happen.
Just to see what would happen.
That's what he said.
Are you sure this isn't fake news, Terry?
This is not fake news. I looked at it at a number of different sites. So it's like this kid just wanted to find out what would happen if he developed a DNA strand.
You know, that just tells me that somebody's got too much time on their hands. I do know this, though. You got to be so careful these days about fake news. Steve and I are at Breakforth, and in between my session, an attendee came up to me and showed me this news article about how scientists in Saudi Arabia have now declared that women are mammals, to which Steve and I, and she was quite upset about this, right?
Yeah.
You know, you won't believe this, and I didn't, actually. So Steve and I kind of looked at it, and I said, well, Steve, could you talk with this lady and get that news article and they'll send it to me, right? And so he did. And then I looked at it, and you then type
you
in
have this, a sense.
Well, yeah. Yeah. You start reading it, right? And all of a sudden these names don't quite match up and everything. And then, so then I just did a quick Google search of this magazine, and then they're quite upfront that it's satirical.
Yeah.
But wow, it's interesting how easy it is for people to buy into that. But this one, who knows?
True, well, it was covered by Fox News.
Yeah. So. So.
Initially, I got it from The Sun, which I don't know. You got to wonder sometimes, but it was covered by a number of sources that I came across.
So. Well, let me just tell you one more that just came out. Wired Magazine just covered this one. I don't know if you guys heard of that Israeli company that just came out within the last couple of weeks of declaring that within a year they're going to have a cure for cancer.
Yeah, I saw that title. I didn't read the article, but...
Yeah, that one swept the internet quick. Well, they just came out that one is bogus. So, there you go. On that positive note...
We do not want fake news on this program. So, if anybody hears about this and... Yeah, tell us whether it's fake or not. All right. Last night, Andy and I had the privilege of being on a panel, and it was with regards to a new research project that came out called Renegotiating Faith. So it was about a 182-page document. It was in partnership with Power to Change, students at InterVarsity and Youth for Christ, Truth Matters Ministries, and the Evangelical Fellowship of Canada.
And it was the Evangelical Fellowship of Canada that was spearheading this.
That's correct, yeah. And so they had one of their guys that contributed to the document, Rick Heinstra. And so he was out last night, and he did a presentation about it. There was a panel discussion with four of us.
Yeah, and his presentation was fantastic.
It was, yeah.
CBC, who we partnered with in this event, recorded it, so we will try to get that out. When we started Apologetics Canada, It was in response to young adults that were leaving the church, particularly in the United States. I heard Lee Strobel talking about just this overwhelming amount of young people that were abandoning the faith. And that's really what spearheaded Apologetics Canada. And ultimately me coming to Canada with it, because I'm originally from the U.S. My wife and I were planning on heading off to the mission field, and really we felt called to come back to Canada as a mission field, not just as a pastor, but as a like a missionary slash pastor. And shortly after coming back, starting Apologetics Canada, a research was done in Canada and was published called Hemorrhaging Faith. Mm-hmm. And that was in 2011. And that study really just detailed what was going on specifically in Canada. We already knew this was going on in the United States. Now we got a really clear picture of what was taking place in Canada. And so that happened in 2011. And so now here we are in 2019, and Renegotiating Faith has just come out. Now, this is a follow-up study to what was done in 2011.
Yeah, so Renegotiating Faith wants to answer the question, how we can help young people, young adults, who are transitioning from high school to the next phases in life to stay connected with the church and faith. We will discuss a number of issues. We went over four last night. There's a lot to discuss in this document itself.
And it might help just to let our listeners know, just kind of give them a bit of an overview of what this study was looking at. As far as I could tell, I did a quick read through the document. And what I saw was basically it revolves around the idea that adulthood is being postponed more so than, say, 30 years ago. So, say, young adults today, their shift into adulthood is being delayed by 5 to 7 years compared to their counterparts from the 1980s. And, you know, they're getting married later, they're having children later, they live with their parents longer, so on and so forth. So,
some of the other ones just are leaving school later, family formation, full-time work.
Right. And so then in between the teenage years and adulthood, there is this, they're calling it the emerging adulthood stage. This is becoming a thing now.
And he called it a moratorium. It's a place where the young adults are kind of stuck in for this period of time. And there's some indecision about what they want to do and what's their next steps in life.
Now, Steve, you and I have been studying this for a while in preparation for the Human Project and specifically the work we did in Korea and in the filming we did there. Mm-hmm. Now, this is not something that's just taking place in North America. These sorts of things are happening around the world, particularly in Korea. Now, in Korea, this is called the generation that's given up on the five.
Right.
They've given up on dating, given up on marriage, given up on children, owning a home, and having a career. Now, as you know, Steve, in our conversations with young adults in Korea, specifically South Korea, they now call this the generation that's given up on everything.
Everything, yeah.
Yeah, it's not just the five anymore. And so in Canada, you know, it's not so much that they've given up on these things, although I would argue it's heading in that direction. And particularly, I think it's dependent on where you are in Canada. Here in British Columbia, housing is very expensive. Mm-hmm. Now, and I just want to say this actually off the bat, because I know we have a number of listeners from Australia, the United States, and around the world. And so some might be thinking, you know, this is just about Canada. What does this podcast have to do with me? And I just bring that up with regards to Korea, because this is something that's happening around the world. I think that you can take a look at what's going on here in Canada, and you can see this taking place where you are to differing levels. Mm-hmm. And I'd even say that this is true of differing levels within Canada. For example, here in British Columbia, housing is very expensive. On average, particularly the closer you get to Vancouver, I mean, these days you're not going to find anything less than 1.5 million, I would probably say, in the Vancouver. And we're talking about a dump.
Yeah. Yeah. When I talk to people here in Alberta, you know, people ask, what brings your family to Alberta? One of the reasons I'll tell them is because of the housing crisis, and my family just couldn't get into the housing market.
Right. And so what you have then, as I talk with young adults, is there's this hopelessness. How do I own a home? How do I survive when these prices for things are so high? So it's not just housing. Car insurance is extremely high. And again, it differs on where you are in Canada. British Columbia, it's extremely high. Steve will tell you, in Alberta, it's about half the price.
Not even.
So what you do find is that there is a bit of a mass exodus in some regards. People tend to leave British Columbia elsewhere in Canada because it's more affordable.
Case in point right here.
Yeah, and Steve being one of those. And so that starts to help you understand where this emerging young adults are starting to do something that's called differentiation, where they're beginning to differentiate between them and their parents as they're on this journey of adulthood.
But now it's just been extended to a older time, I guess you could say. Like back in the 80s, this is when the report was saying that it was transitioning to this emergent adulthood. Before that, once you hit grade 12, you know, you'd start developing your own sense of identity, right? Mm-hmm. Now that sense of identity has moved to further up the scale of age,
right,
into the 20s, right? So forming of identity is now moved and it's more difficult.
And it creates challenges that this study brings up. So just to give some clarity, I think you might find this interesting, listeners, just to give you a definition here. Differentiation is the process of setting out identity markers between you and your family of origin and sometimes your close community of origin. Now, in the past, this is often done by getting a career, by owning a home, starting a family. But if you have this delayed adolescence, arrested development, for those of you that watch the show, if you have that, you're now needing to look for other ways that you can differentiate between you and your parents, especially when you are living in their home for longer than in the past. And one of the markers that often young adults are grabbing hold of and trying to differentiate is through religion. So the religion of the parents that is being shared in the family now is an easy marker for you to go, well, you know, I'm not the same as you in this regard. So, I mean, at least here's one thing that I can kind of be unique in as I'm trying to develop as an adult.
Because they can't achieve these other things, right? Of buying a home and all, you know, the things that you mentioned earlier. Mm-hmm. So it's moved to more focus on this religious piece and differentiating themselves from their parents on this piece.
What I read also is that young adults or emerging adults, they consistently list three criteria for adulthood. So in their minds, if you have these three things, you're an adult, right? So first is accepting responsibility for yourself. Second is making independent decisions. And the third is becoming financially independent. So you can kind of see that theme of you're standing on your two feet, kind of an idea, right? And that also extends to their religious identity.
So you can see this as a very almost individualistic outlook in the sense it's about themselves. I mean, once you hit adulthood, it expanded more to other responsibilities, right? Mm-hmm. But this is more internal about themselves.
Well, and I think you see that as well, that's being driven from a more and more individualistic culture, especially one that's being driven via social media. Mm-hmm. And so what the report begins to hone in on is the importance of mentorship. Now, that's kind of a big umbrella catch for a number of different ideas, from discipleship to just relationships. And during our panel discussion, this is one of the areas I really wanted to focus on, because I would argue that this is an aspect in which the church needs to understand in more depth than is normally grappled with. I mean, often when we think of mentorship, and by the way, I would say that this study is bang on. Mentorship is critical, but we need to understand what mentorship is, because a lot of people in the church have this idea that a mentor is somebody older than you, wiser than you. You know, it's an adult that is investing in you. Mm-hmm. And one of the problems with this, because I have a problem with this idea of mentorship that's often understood in the church, because this often drives the problem in the beginning, and that is a very consumer, individualistic mentality of viewing church, right? You know, I'm coming there to consume this product that's made for me, and church is all about me, and there are people in this church that should mentor me. And what begins to take place is church becomes all about you, and you forget that church is about about a relationship. Mm-hmm. Churches is a mutual caring for one another. And so one of the points that I made last night, and I think it's important as we move forward working with young adults to understand, is that mentorship also and necessarily needs to take place at a peer-to-peer level, mm-hmm. where we are helping one another. And I would argue that in my life, the three most influential relationships from my childhood to today were my friends. I had three buddies, Brian, Ryan, and Sean, that loved Jesus. And they were incredible mentors in my life to this day.
Yep.
And I was actually sharing with somebody last night, there are a lot of things that I didn't get into, drugs, sex, number of other things, or I should say harder drugs. I dabbled in marijuana, that I didn't get into because of them.
Mm-hmm. So last night, Rick Heimstra, and I think this applies to peer mentoring as well as those that are older. He mentioned what mentors are. He said, called out what God has placed inside. This is pertaining to your mentee. Mm-hmm. Our reintroducers, our negotiation advisors, our continuity. So those are really key.
Let's unpack that.
Yeah, yeah. So call out what God has placed inside. So I think a lot of people, a lot of young adults, don't know what they want. So it's,
or
it's
who they are.
Who they are. And for somebody to come along and say, I see a gifting that you have. Have you ever explored this? Right? And to bring that out within themselves, just recognize it and explore it.
In Christianity, we would call this blessing people. It's where you come up alongside somebody and you say, you know what, Terry, doggone it. you are, you know, fantastic.
I always wanted to be a rapper. Are you going to say that?
Yeah, you are fantastic at. Rapping.
Rapping. Yeah. That's what I want to do here.
You can tell that there's a lot of blessing that goes on in Apologetics Canada. No, but seriously, right? So you're encouraging. By the way, I will never forget, you know, cursings come as well. Often we curse more than we bless. The very first sermon that I ever did, the youth pastor came up to me afterwards. I'm just this college student, right? He comes up to me afterwards and says, that is the worst sermon I have ever heard. I kid you not. And then he said, clearly you are not gifted for preaching.
Oh, wow.
Your voice is monotone.
Oh.
Stop now.
Oh.
Ouch.
That's got to hurt.
Yeah. Yeah, that one. That stung a bit.
That was a little negative. It wasn't very positive. Yeah. So, I mean, we want somebody that comes up and notices.
And knows by the way.
And knows.
This guy didn't know me.
Yeah, yeah.
He didn't know, you know, right. whether or not I was gifted or not. I mean, he just had an opinion. Yeah, so it's somebody who knows you and notices.
And cares for you, and you can trust.
Yep. Right.
And in all of this, I'm seeing just the critical importance of community, right? One thing that I've noticed in the study is that the way the emerging adults maintain their religious identity, the first month after they move to a new school or move to a new job or something like that, it's really critical. And people who engage in a new sort of a Christian campus group or something like that, when they do that within the first month, the retaining rate of their religious identity just skyrockets.
Well, in fact, the numbers on that is that within the first 2 weeks, 37% will stay engaged in a Christian community.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah.
If they're introduced. Now, this goes back to what you were saying, Terry. What's that next piece on this?
Our reintroducers.
Yeah, our reintroducers. Now, Steve, I think this is such an important concept for us to understand in church ministry. The importance of, you know, so you've been in this community, this relationship with this kid who's grown up in the church and has gone off to high school. And often we forget that there is this transitioning into adulthood where young adults tend to fly, right? They tend to head off to university. They tend to get married and head off to different locations for jobs or whatever that might be. And the importance of the church realizing that we have a responsibility, and I found this very convicting. We have a responsibility to reintroduce them into a different community. Mm-hmm. And the importance of that, whether that be a community at their college campus or that be a church. And I just had this the other day, a young adult is working in Scotland in a school. And she said, Andy, can you help me find a community here? And just me realizing, you know, this is part of my responsibility is to help this young adult that's looking for a good church and struggling. And so I did my due diligence and helped mm-hmm. her to find a church. But I'm beginning to realize, you know, I need to be more proactive in doing that and less reactive.
In finding their identity, he talked about these young people being known as their parents', you know, names. So reintroducing them into the church, with finding their identity, finding that who they are within that church, not belonging to this family of sort, but finding that identity in themselves and moving them all along in the church as well as, you know, other parts like university and stuff as well.
Yeah, I am always reminded of that story that you told us, Andy, about that time in Scotland when you were about to enter into a church and you didn't. Mm-hmm. Often we don't appreciate it, or we forget just how difficult it was, even for us, to break into a new community. Here you are in Scotland and you're a pastor and you're about to enter into this church and you have your hand on the door handle and then you second guess yourself, right? Am I welcome here? Am I supposed to go in? What if they are having a mass or a service? Is this even the door that I should go in? I mean, just the unknown is really intimidating and you're not sure because you don't want to necessarily cause a scene or disrupt other people, you know, when they're doing something important. So you just walked away, didn't you? And so I think that's why it's so important that as mentors and as church communities, you actually help them get connected when they say go off to university or college. It's hard enough when you go there and you actually know a couple of people, but when you say move away really far away to a whole new environment, to a new school, it's really hard to find that community and get yourself plugged in. It takes a lot of work. I don't think a lot of young adults, quite honestly, have the kind of mental energy to manage.
Now, on that note, one of the things that came out in the report and is one of those that, you know, again, is convicting because we often it's those things that are the closest to us that are the simplest that we often will miss. And one of those is even just the simple, not just those who head off to college, because there are many that won't. There are many that are going to transition, say, from a high school ministry into a young adult ministry. Mm-hmm. And often we forget how intimidating even that process is in helping a young adult to connect into, you know, this next phase of emerging adulthood. And so one of the things that I've been finding is absolutely critical is community groups. So in a community group, you begin to help these, and again, you need to be a reintroducer. Even within your own church, right? You can't assume just because they've been coming to church and they're in the high school group that they're going to just naturally transition into adulthood, into the young adults department. Not the case, right? They need to be reintroduced now into a new community. I often find the same thing will happen when they head off into adulthood and getting into an adult community or whatever. But I find that transition much more smooth and natural when they go from young adult into adult. And the reason for this is simple. Often they've gotten married and now they're just naturally connecting with young marrieds, or they've gotten married and they've had children and they're again just naturally connecting with that demographic. The one that I see is challenging and we drop a lot of people is from high school into young adulthood. And so it's so important in that transition to reintroduce, help them get connected into a community. And in that community group, what you find is these people know your name. They know you. They hear your prayer requests. They pray for you. There is a natural mentorship that begins to take place in these groups. So important.
I was kind of shocked last night. I was talking to a guy that we both know, all three of us know, and he works with the local universities and colleges around here. And he said they have no indication of churches getting contact with any Christian organizations at those universities or colleges and just letting them know that we have a young lady or a young man that is coming to your university. Would you be willing to connect with them? It's almost still in a sense that the kids are going to the college and it's their responsibility to try to connect with these organizations, which I think we need to do a little better at.
Again, that was where I was convicted.
Yeah.
We must do better.
Yeah. So the third one kind of ties in with the second. It says our negotiation advisors. So we're strong advocates for our mentee. you know, we are there for them. We're at the negotiation table, even within the churches, right? We're there sitting with them and helping them navigate, even just within the church, as well as within the university.
And the importance of developing leaders. That's kind of the way the terminology I would more use is, for us, one of our biggest challenges is to identify those young adults that are doing well, right? That are following the Lord, that are natural leaders that we can come alongside of and we can build into and release into ministry. That's the natural part of the whole becoming an adult. Now, one of the things that came up, though, in this study that I thought was helpful to understand, and something that we at Apologetics Canada have been really wrestling with and thinking a lot about, is this idea of young adults and their fear of adulthood. And you see that quite often where young adults will become very withdrawn, often afraid of large groups of coming out to things. And you begin to see that they are perpetuating in some regards this extended adolescence. Now, one of the things that Rick brought up that I thought was just fantastic last night is he brought up kind of, you know, this juxtaposition between emerging adulthood and what he called the real world. And you can begin to see this. So emerging adulthood would be people are young, they're beautiful and healthy, you know. You remember those days, right, Terry? Right? But then there's the real world, right, where people are old, less beautiful, and less healthy. And so you begin to see that you would naturally want to hold on to that emerging adulthood as long as you can, especially if that's your view of the real world that's out there. So another one would be creating is easy as an emerging young adult, but creating is hard in the real world. As an emerging young adult, I'm in control, whereas in the real world, others are in control. As a young adult, you know, you are living in a socially rich environment, whereas the real world, and you can even see this as you scroll, you know, Facebook or Instagram or whatever, right? Whereas you see that the real world's a socially isolating environment. Another one is that as a young adult, you are rich in a variety of activities, whereas you look at the real world and it's dull and repetitive activities. A young adult, networking's easy, but in the real world, networking is hard. And lastly, for a young adult, groups are customized to me, whereas in the real world, I have to fit in with groups as they present themselves.
Yeah, who would want to leave that? I'm all about that.
Right. So, yeah. So you can appreciate that young adults want to hold on to that as long as they can if that's their negative view of adulthood. Now, this is the insight that I thought was quite helpful, is how social media drives that stereotype. Mm-hmm. As social media tends to provide this kind of view to the young adult that this is the way things look for you as a young adult, and the real world out there looks this way. Now, the juxtaposition that Rick made that was an interesting one is he brings up the heresy of Manichaeism, where you've got the spiritual is good and the physical is bad, right? This was an ancient heresy that St. Augustine actually encountered and addressed, where this is now being shown in the 21st century with regards to the spiritual being social media type things, being my online persona versus the real world being the physical and being the negative. And so then you can see where people would tend to want to live more in the social media realm, less in the real realm.
Yeah, well, let's just talk just for a minute about the fears and anxieties, because it applies to what you're talking to. Well, he mentioned three last night that they are experiencing young adults, and it's FOMO, the fear of missing out.
Right. This is perfect, because this is what follows from all this.
Right. Yeah. And FNBA, the fear of not being amazing, and FOPM, fear of passionless monotony. So the first one, FOMO, is young adults just don't want to be left out. So this really applies to social media. People look on media. They're delaying decisions for a lot of different things, like marriage. You know, there might be another person out there for me. What party I'm going to? There might be a better party over here.
Or if I'll go to church on Sunday, I got to think about it because there might be something better happening on Sunday morning, right?
Right, right, right.
Yeah, you're always just kind of waiting till the last minute, right, until you're going to make a decision because you're always checking to see if there's something better that's going to come along.
Right. So the second one, fear of not being amazing. It's the struggle to make the best choices in life and delay big decisions relating to their career. So we found out last night that career and identity just go hand in hand. Mm-hmm. So, you know, there's that struggle of making these choices and delaying the big decisions.
This is a huge one, by the way. Of all the ones, I think this one lands the hardest. By the way, I think we're all experiencing this. You know, nobody wants to go to McDonald's and flip hamburgers, right? And you're definitely not going to Instagram that because that's not, you know, viewed as amazing. And so people then begin to feel quite down on themselves because their job just doesn't live up to this life that you should have, right? Because you get used to following different people in which they're posting all this amazing stuff. And you kind of compare it to your own life and you're like, well, my vacations don't look that great and my university's not that awesome. My career's not that cool, right? And now you start to really feel down on yourself because working, you know, 9 to 5 in a warehouse just isn't as cool as what, you know, my buddy who's a photographer and he's helicoptering off to his next destination, taking pictures of a bunch of models on some waterfall, right? And so then you start to get quite down on yourself.
And the thing with social media, too, is that it is by nature a very selective tool in the sense that people are only going to show you what they want you to see. It actually reminds me of this one cartoon that I saw on Facebook where you see this mom and a dad with this young baby, maybe a couple months old or something like that. And you know, the baby's throwing a fit and the mom and the dad, they're like sweating buckets trying to calm the baby down. And when the baby stops crying for just a couple seconds, they're like, quick, quick, take a picture. The baby stopped crying. So they all take a picture smiling and then they immediately go back to, you know, sweating buckets because the baby has lost it again. That sort of thing.
But in the meantime, they're posting that to Instagram.
Right. And so what we see is, wow, this is a picture perfect family when it is anything but.
Mm-hmm. And this begins to affect the way that we see the world and the way that we see ourselves and starts to have interesting effects on how my identity is being formed by what I'm consuming, particularly on social media.
So the last one, fear of passionless monotony. They want to make a difference, but they want to follow their passions, right? Mm-hmm. And avoid monotonous, dull work, you know, the real world. They want to avoid that. So they come to a point in their life and make decisions that they go to university, they're going to get this career, you know, they start working and it is just not fun at all. So he called it the quarter life crisis. Mm-hmm. So mid-20s, you know, they come to a point where they're just like, this is not cool.
I see this quite a bit. I think that there is even some of us who've experienced this as well. I don't know. Mm-hmm. This is just, you know, right. Land with young out. Because I remember when I graduated from college, I remember thinking, that's it. You know, at first, when you start to go to college, you think, wow, this is a really big mountain, you know, and you wonder, am I ever going to summit this thing? And then you get to the top of it and you're excited for a little while there. And then all of a sudden reality hits and you're like, I'm actually going to have to get a career now. Right. And then you start looking for a career and then you're working in this and you're like, this is where the challenge comes is as soon as you start to make this an identity marker, coming back to the study, as soon as you're starting to define yourself in these ways, you're in deep trouble if your identity is being defined by your career, by these moments in your life. This is where Christianity becomes so important and your faith becomes so important. And we've really, there's so much to say on this whole study, and we haven't even gotten to one of the major pieces of all of this.
I know.
And I think that we've got to hit on this because as people are trying to develop their identity and they're trying to understand who they are, and they're now leaning towards the spiritual foundation that's been built, Well, in 2011, with the work that Christian Smith did, you see that, you know, moralistic therapeutic deism was kind of the default religion of the time. But now Rick talks about how that has changed.
Right. He calls it the universal Gnostic religious ethics. Is that what you're talking about?
It is. And I think we need to unpack that real quick, because this becomes problematic for the young adult who's trying to develop and understand who they are as they're developing their identity. So let's unpack that for a moment. First of all, I just want to say this is absolutely, I think he's spot on. Mm-hmm. As we engage in evangelism, as we meet with young adults, as we interact in academia, this is what I have been experiencing.
So one of the things that pops out for me is that it's more of an ethic than a religion, right? They're emphasizing being a good person. There's goodness in it rather than a direction toward a good God.
Yeah. If you actually look at some of the, you know, excerpts from the transcripts of the interviews, you kind of get the sense that that's their view of religion. For many emerging adults, what a religion is a code of ethics and nothing more. And I think that presupposition has to be challenged right from the start. I mean, religion is a really difficult concept to define, right? But I always found Greg Kokel's definition really helpful. And the way he talks about it is, a religion really is a take on reality. Christianity has a take on reality. Islam has a take on reality. Atheism has a take on reality. They are each saying, this is the way reality really is. And all of the ethics are just really entailments of that. It's just an implication of how you actually look at the world. And yet, I find that a lot of emerging adults are going about it the other way. They're just starting from the wrong end.
And this is exemplified in the Gnostic part of this equation. And that is that young adults have this understanding, or we should say our culture at large has really morphed to this understanding that they have risen above. They have this Gnostic, they have this special knowledge where they can see what other people can't see. This is critical, and I think this is why that idea of religion is important, and Steve, I appreciated that you put atheism in there, because our culture at large has really moved away from atheism and has really just kind of incorporated that now into the religious milieu that we live in. However, people see themselves as having risen above, not just, you know, religion in your normal context being Christianity, Islam, you know, Buddhism, whatever that might be, but atheism as well, right? So that they've kind of risen above, they can see what other people can't see. And very individualistically, they have this concept of this ethic of what the good is. But this ethic has no foundation outside of just their very pagan, very new age view of, I kind of, through my crystals, through my yoga, whatever it might be, I've kind of risen above to be able to see what you can't see. Mm-hmm. And this, by the way, really has an effect then on, in young adults, their relationship with their parent. So they've gone to church their whole life, their parents are Christians, but now as they're becoming an adult, they're differentiating and they're kind of rising above, right? It's very Nietzschean, this idea, you know, it's the 21st century version of the Ubermensch, right? That now I can see what my parent can't see, and I'm taking this higher ground where Christianity, that's great for you, but really there's this higher ethic that you're not seeing that becomes very relativistic of religion in general.
Yeah, and I think that's why it's so important for parents to be ready and to be equipped, get training in apologetics and world religions and different things like that. And we actually need to be able to show our children, actually, I'm not just being dogmatic here. I've actually studied this thing and I understand why I believe what I believe. I'm not just brainwashed by my church. I looked into this and I've considered what you're considering right now. And this is where I landed.
Mm-hmm. So another piece to it that I noticed was that this new ethic, this new default faith, I think he called it last night as well, is atheological. There's no need for a God. In the moralistic therapeutic deism, there is mention of God. But in this new frame of thought, there's no mention of God. There doesn't need to be one. Mm-hmm. Not even heaven or hell needs to be discussed.
That's right. Because what you find is that there's just this higher power that becomes very ambiguous, that in fact it becomes detrimental to try to define what it is, because then it would take away from your autonomy to decide what what is right and what is wrong in this higher ethic. I've said this before, but just to give you a perspective on this, in my doctoral work, when I went out to Aberdeen the first day, they were having a crystal bazaar on campus. Now, think about that. I mean, we often think about how secular Europe and particularly the UK is. And here they're buying and selling crystals, trying to tap into this higher power. That's one of the reasons why I've stopped really seeing secularism as this atheistic thing, and it's more now just a pagan thing, more of like a New Age kind of understanding. There is a spirituality there. I think there's positive aspects, right?
Right.
We're recognizing that there's a spirituality there. We are recognizing that there's an ethic there. I see this even in academia, where objective moral values are being claimed more and more in academics. And that's really amazing. Now, the question becomes, well, how are they claiming hold of this objective moral value? And we've talked a little bit about this and the way that academics are doing it. You don't see this necessarily with lay people. They just will grab hold of an ethic and not found it. But in academics, I'm finding that they're holding on to Neoplatonism is becoming more of a foundation by which they're trying to substantiate their view that there is an objective ethic.
Yeah, and Neoplatonism being that there are these universals, right? So there is such a thing as justice, kindness, goodness, all of these things are sort of in the upper sphere of the world, so to speak, beyond this just sort of the physical reality. And when our actions conform to those things, we can say that an action is just, kind, good.
Now consider how relative that is, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because now it just plays perfectly into this Gnosticism. You are tapping into this higher ethic and you can see what other people, again, can't see. Now, there are some of us that were in agreement. There is this higher ethic. There is an ethic. But it really gives you a lot of autonomy to decide what that ethic is.
Mm. Mm. So, I mean, he said one of the most important things, too, about this view is that it wants to preserve social harmony. Mm-hmm. Good human beings.
Social justice warriors.
Good human beings preserve social harmony. Mm-hmm. That's very relative, too.
Well, it is. And it also explains why so many young adults have a hard time loving people and disagreeing with them at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Because it doesn't fall into this idea of social harmony. So if you want to preserve social harmony, you really need to have more of this kind of view that you're just accepting and you don't disagree with people, right? If you love them, well, then for social harmony, you're going to have to agree mm-hmm. with them.
Let's maybe talk a little bit how we move forward with apologetics in this new view, I guess mm-hmm. we could say, within young adults. Apologetics Canada is focused in that area. So with this new idea, this ergry, how do we move forward?
I'll just give you one way that we move forward that might surprise people. And that is we have got to recognize that we are relational human beings and the importance of community. So if you want to help your emerging young adult, help them find good community. I talked with a lady at Breakforth and I asked her this question. I said, do you like going to church? Steve, you were there. Your eyes filled with tears and she started crying. And she goes, no, I don't. And I said, do your kids like going to church? And she goes, no, they don't. They asked not to go to church.
Hmm.
And I looked at her and I just said, find a healthy church.
Yeah.
You know, you want to help your young adult negotiate this world, this craziness, help them to have good community. Because one of the things that came out clearly in this report is how helpful that is in differentiation. In owning their faith, when they're in a tight community, this helps them to navigate that and, in fact, helps them to not see that their faith is something that they need to differentiate from. Their faith is something that they can latch hold of and, in fact, is going to help them as they begin to become an adult and they begin to differentiate in different ways. They don't have to use their faith to do that because they have so many other friends, common ground that is keeping them and mentoring them in the faith. That's an important apologetic, right? We often think about the head. Listen, we got to think about how to do just apologetics practically. Of the heart.
Of the heart, yeah.
Of a relational human being. Mm-hmm. Guys, I'm preaching. I'm getting fired up over
Come
here.
Come on.
As I was reading this study, I was reminded so much of the hemorrhaging faith study. In fact, this study refers to hemorrhaging faith a number of times. So I think I would encourage our listeners to go to our website and actually look up hemorrhaging faith, if you can even spell the word hemorrhaging, that is. But you'll see a synopsis there, and I think it'll be a really good review, and it'll get you prepped better as you read through this study. But one thing I noticed that I was just really struck by is the role of parents. That came into the picture again very strongly, and especially fathers. The study was mentioning how children who have a warm, close relationship, especially with a father, they tend to have this religious transmission far better. Your children actually need to see you live out your faith, right? I feel convicted even as I'm saying this, because I see so many places where I can improve in this. But I think, again, your parental influence, fathers and mothers both, are going to be just so important in the way your children grow up and form that religious identity and create that differentiation.
This is, I think, just a very practical note from the study for you parents to consider. One of the things that came out is how helpful going to Christian camps can be. Mm-hmm. And one of the other ones, and this one surprised me, and I think we need to take note of this, and that is how helpful a gap year can be to, say, sending your kid off to a YWAM. Now, I know that there are many, myself included, that used to really see that as a waste of time and a big expense, and why bother with that kind of thing? And one thing that really came out in this study is that, you know, the numbers of young adults that go off and have one of those gap years, go off to a Cape and Ray, go off to a YWAM, do some time in mission, and they stay in the faith is astronomical. It's really something worth considering if your kid is thinking about that, or maybe even just encouraging that, finding a good place that they can go and experience Christian community. Now, it doesn't always end well. There are times that it doesn't, but do your due diligence to find a great place where, you know, they're teaching the word, that they're doing a good job, and that your child can really grow in community. And then again, though, so important, notice what you're doing. You're helping them find a community. And when they come back, you're going to help them find a new community. It's something that we as a church, not just parents, but we as the church need to help our young adults with.
Relationship, community. These are the songs that we sing at Apologetics Canada.
And I'm just going to add one other one. And I mentioned this last night. And I think we have to bring others to a point of asking the question, what do I think of Jesus? Because ultimately, that's going to be our ground, our focus, because it brings us back to our humanity, right? It brings us back to our identity as humans.
In Christ.
All of this is formed in Christ. So that,
which is, again, relational.
And
right?
I was thinking that last night, and then I was just thinking about you guys doing your sermon series in young adults this past month or so, right? Or even started before
like
Christmas.
It's like 3 months that we're doing Jesus.
Jesus. Yeah, yeah. So that's just my little throw in there. But I think we need to communicate the brilliance and the beauty of Jesus.
Amen,
as
brother.
We move forward.
That's a good note to stop on.
Well, this one has been a long one, and we need to wrap up.
This is an important one, though.
This is an important one. But we appreciate you, listeners, and thank you for joining us. The AC Podcast is a ministry of Apologetics Canada, and we'll come back next week with more things to think about.